Tommy loved Mr. Johnson. You see, Mr. Johnson was the sixth grade science teacher, and Mr. Johnson knew more about science than anybody that Tommy had ever seen. Mr. Johnson made learning science fun, which was a considerable feat for someone who was teaching sixth grade science. He would take the sixth graders out on nature walks, and he would talk to them about all the various different kinds of grass and trees and bugs and beetles. And every now and then, Tommy heard something from Mr. Johnson that he didn't really agree with, in so much as it was something different than his parents taught him. Like when he would take them on nature walks, he would say, "Isn't it amazing how this beetle evolved the ability to fly?" Or, "Isn't it amazing how this tree evolved the ability to do this or that?" But it never really dawned on Tommy what was going on when they went over the section on the dinosaurs. Mr. Johnson talked about how the dinosaurs evolved millions of years ago and died out, but that didn't really dawn on Tommy either. Not until today did Tommy realize what was going on. You see, today Mr. Johnson stood in front of the class and he said, "Class, we're going to learn about the origin of the universe. Can anyone tell me how that started?" Eugene Lepton's hand. The sixth grader who read his science book for fun, who made a 100 on every science test unless there was a bonus question, and then he made 105. He said, "Yes, sir, I can." And Mr. Johnson said, "Yes, Eugene." And Eugene rattled off the textbook spiel. "About 13.7 billion years ago, a tiny ball of matter about the size of a period exploded in what is commonly referred to as the Big Bang. Immediately after that Big Bang, something called inflation sent our universe into existence," and gave the standard evolutionary answer. Well, Mr. Johnson said, "That is terrific, Eugene. Can anyone tell me how life began?" Well, Katie raised her hand. And Mr. Johnson said, "Yes, Katie." She said, standard textbook evolutionary spiel, she said, "About 4.8 billion years ago, there was a warm chemical soup on the surface of the earth. Something like lightning struck that warm chemical soup, bringing in the energy necessary to form the first building blocks of life. Over multiplied billions of years, that life evolved and changed from a single-celled organism to humans." "Very good, Mr. Johnson," said to Katie. Well, now Tommy had a problem. Tommy now realized what all of those things that were being said about the beetles evolving and the dinosaurs evolving, what those meant now. What those meant was that if evolution and atheism were really true, then everything that his mother and father had taught him about Adam and Eve and the creation of the entire universe in six literal 24-hour days, as it's depicted in Genesis chapter 1, was false. He realized that the smartest man he felt like he had ever known, Mr. Johnson, was telling him something that his parents had been teaching him the opposite of his entire life. And Tommy was not alone. 80% of the class of sixth graders were all sitting there with the exact same mental struggle. And a little hand went up in the back. Stephen. His dad was the preacher down the road, and Mr. Johnson said, "Yes, Stephen." And Stephen, in a very nervous but courageous voice, said, "Mr. Johnson, that's not right." He said, "My dad says that God created the world in 6 days and everything in it." Well, now, that's what 80% of the class had been taught all of their lives, and they quickly whipped their heads around to see what Mr. Johnson would do with that piece of information. And they were all surprised when a smile crept across Mr. Johnson's face and he said, "Thank you, Stephen, for bringing that up. I was hoping someone would. Where'd your dad get that idea?" And Stephen said, "The Bible." And Mr. Johnson went over to his desk and opened his top left-hand drawer and pulled out a leather book. And he turned it to the first few pages and he started reading. He said, "Stephen, was that Bible anything like this?" And Stephen said, yes, it looked very similar to that, and started reading the Genesis account of creation. And there were some words that the class was not familiar with, like hath and doest and maketh and things like that. And Mr. Johnson said, class, does this sound like an old book? And they had to admit, it did sound old. It sounded, you know, from something not very modern. He said, let me tell you about this book. It is an old book. It's one of the oldest books we have. And this book is great if you want to learn things about morality and how to treat others. And he said, this book is great if you want to learn some things about history. But he said, this book is absolutely useless if you want to learn any legitimate, proven scientific information. In fact, he said with a chuckle, the people who wrote this book thought that the earth was flat because they wrote about the four corners of the earth. Now, we know modern science has disproven that silly idea many years ago, and this book is filled with silly ideas from ancient people who didn't know what we know today. And he put that book back in his drawer, and he closed that, and he left 26th graders struggling in their minds to decide which idea they were going to accept. The one from what they considered to be probably the smartest man in science that they had ever known, or the idea that their parents had been teaching them for their entire lives. Make no mistake, my friends, it is in a sixth grade class like that that some 12-year-olds decide to believe in evolution. Now you think, oh, that doesn't necessarily happen. Surely there aren't people out there who would suggest to us that evolution is absolutely proven, that it is a fact, and that we can teach that to our children, and that our children need to believe that evolution is unquestionably proven. Oh, there are. In fact, I want you to see that there are numerous examples of people who would make statements like evolution of the animal and plant world is considered by all those entitled to a judgment to be a fact for which no further proof is needed. No serious biologist today doubts the fact of evolution. All reputable biologists have agreed that evolution of life on earth is an established fact. Evolution is a fact like digestion. These are statements from evolutionists who are saying you can't be a serious, reputable, legitimate scientist and still believe in something other than evolution. This angers me for a number of reasons, not the least of which there are multiplied thousands of people who have attained their terminal PhD degrees in various subjects relating to these scientific areas that are 100% creationist, who believe the Bible account of creation. Thousands of them all across the world. And yet, a person like Stephen Jay Gould, who would say that evolution is a fact, like apples falling out of trees, would suggest that you can't be a serious biologist and not believe in evolution. That is absolutely, positively incorrect. I want you to continue with me. Evolution is a fact like apples falling out of trees. The first point to make about Darwin's theory is that it's no longer a theory, but a fact. No serious scientist would deny the fact that evolution has occurred. Oh, there are thousands of serious scientists that deny it with every fiber in their being. But I want you to see how indoctrinated these people have become as to the idea of evolution. Evolution, Stephen Jay Gould says, is as well documented as any phenomena in science, as strongly as the Earth's revolution around the sun, rather than vice versa. In this sense, we can call evolution a fact. Recently, in the U.S. News and World Report, an article was written in which the statement appeared, by now scientists say evolution is no longer just a theory, it is an everyday phenomenon, a fundamental fact of biology as real as hunger and as unavoidable as death. Do you think there are people out there who would suggest to you that evolution is a proven fact? Oh, absolutely. In fact, they would not only suggest it to you, but they would feel it their obligation to teach that to your children. Now, I want you to read again this statement that Eric Lyons brought before us in a previous lecture from a man by the name of Daniel Dennett. Daniel Dennett said that if you send your children to us, us being the public school systems, then we will, if your children have been taught something other than evolution, those of us who have free speech will feel free to describe your teachings as the spreading of falsehood and will attempt to demonstrate this to your children at our earliest opportunity. Do you think this doesn't happen? Think again. I was in Maryland recently, several months ago, and I was sitting across the table from a young man who was a junior in high school and another young man who was in eighth grade. And in that school, they explained to me that you could no longer read your Bible. You couldn't have a Bible open. You couldn't have a Bible where anyone could see it. This 11th grader explained to me that he had his Bible open, and the assistant principal of the school came by and told him he could not read that Bible anymore and he had to put it up. They also informed me that if you went into the library and you got on the internet and you typed in Bible or Christian, the internet sites that would have anything to do with Christian or Bible were blocked and you could not access them. Why is that? Because men like Daniel Dennett have made it their life's aim to make sure that your child believes that evolution is a fact. But I'm here to tell you that that belief would be based on something other than legitimate scientific evidence. In fact, the statement that you are going to read from the Cobb County, Georgia textbooks describes the reality of evolutionary teaching. It says, "This textbook contains material on evolution. Evolution is a theory, not a fact, regarding the origin of living things. This material should be approached with an open mind, studied carefully, and critically considered." Now, this particular sticker was placed in front of the biology textbooks in Cobb County, Georgia in 2002. I want you to look at that statement very closely and see what it says. It says that evolution is not a fact, it's a theory, and that when you approach evolution, you should do it with an open mind, study it carefully, and critically consider it. Now, isn't that the point of education? That any system of thought, any philosophy, or any theory should be looked at with an open mind, should be studied carefully, and should be critically considered. In fact, if a theory or idea is true, and you look at it with an open mind, and you study it carefully, and you consider it critically, what will you come away with? The overwhelming conclusion that it is right. Why would a statement like this be considered unconstitutional? Well, there is a very simple reason why a statement like this would be considered unconstitutional. And by the way, that's what it was considered. This was sent to the circuit court judge who struck it and said it is unconstitutional. You cannot put that statement in a textbook. Do you know why he said you can't put that statement in a textbook? He said it's so religiously motivated. It's so filled with religion. It's what? So filled with religion? Read that statement again. Do you read any hint of the Bible, of God, of a creator, of anything of that sort? No. All you read is that you should look at evolution with an open mind, study it carefully, and consider it critically. And yet that statement was considered unconstitutional because they said it was religious. And if you put that in a school system, then you would be harboring a religious idea. And they said you couldn't do that. Here's why they don't want that statement in the books. Because, and listen to me closely, friends, if you ever, with an open mind, consider evolution carefully and critically analyze it, you'll be forced to reject it. And they know it. Let me give you some of the evidence that Mr. Dennett and the others are using on a regular basis to teach the, quote, fact of evolution that is nothing of the sort. You are seeing on your screen two pictures, one of a dark-colored English peppered moth, one of a light-colored English peppered moth. This is presented in many textbooks as an example of evolution taking place so that you can see it. And here's how the scenario supposedly goes. Before the Industrial Revolution, when there were light-colored lichens that grew on tree trunks, then the moth population was 95% light-colored because they blended in with the lichens on the tree trunks. And the moth population was 5% dark-colored because they didn't blend in. And the idea was, if you are a bird and you approach a tree and there's a dark-colored moth that doesn't blend in with the tree and there's a light-colored moth that does, which one will you eat? Well, obviously, you'll eat the one that is not camouflaged, that doesn't blend in. You'll eat the black, darker-colored moth, and that's why there were only 5% of those. Well, they said, after the Industrial Revolution, when soot and smoke were dumped into the atmosphere, the lichens were killed, and the tree trunks on which these English peppered moths land turned black and dark. And guess what happened to the English peppered moth population? Well, it shifted so that 95% of the English peppered moths were the new darker color, not a new color necessarily, but just a greater percentage of them, and only 5% were the lighter color. And they said this is an example of evolution in action. In fact, some of them said it's the best example of evolution that we've got. Don't think that this is not used often in textbooks. This is a textbook that Eric Lyons showed you in a previous lecture, Evolution Change Over Time. On page 61, I want to read to you the statement made about the English peppered moth, and there are two pictures similar to the ones on your screen, and here's the statement made. After the start of the Industrial Revolution, the light gray bark of trees was darkened by the soot from factories. In each photograph, which peppered moth would most likely be noticed by a hungry bird? Now, think about that. Is this an example of evolution in action? Some people say it's one of the best ones we've got. All right? Now, we're going to do some critical thinking. I know that if you do some critical thinking, it's not what people want you to do in regard to stuff that supposedly proves evolution. Before the Industrial Revolution, you had the genetic components and makeup that would produce in the English peppered moth two variations, light-colored and dark-colored. After the Industrial Revolution, you had the genetic makeup and components that would produce in the English peppered moth two variations, dark-colored and light-colored. So the English peppered moth evolved into, drum roll please, the English peppered moth? Did it evolve into half moth, half bird? Did it evolve into a moth with half wings and some scales? No. It evolved into nothing. It evolved from the English peppered moth into the English peppered moth. It didn't evolve anywhere. It started the English peppered moth and it ended the English peppered moth. But that's not what's so disturbing about this particular illustration. What's so disturbing about this particular illustration is that English peppered moths, they don't land on tree trunks. They've been studying for 40 years. From what I can ascertain, they've only ever found two on tree trunks. Now, the pictures that you see in the textbooks are of English peppered moths on tree trunks. The caption that I just read talked about the English peppered moths being on tree trunks. How did the English peppered moths get on the tree trunks in the pictures in the textbooks that are used all over the country? Oh, they pinned some of them there. Or they caught them and artificially placed them on the trees. You see, English peppered moths move at night, and they land under the leaves of trees and not on the tree trunks. Well, you would like to think, okay, maybe the textbook writers and the people who are putting these pictures in didn't know this information. Maybe it was inadvertently put in there, although they just weren't aware of it. No, it's not the case. If you'll look at the bottom of your screen, you'll realize that the quotes I'm about to read to you are from Bob Ritter, a Canadian textbook writer who knew that the English peppered moth's pictures were staged. Here's what he says. He says, well, you got to look at the audience. I mean, how convoluted do you want to make it for a first-time learner? Then he says, the advantage of this example of natural selection is that it's extremely visual. Now stop right there. Suppose I've got a theory. Oh, it's my little pet theory, and I believe that it really happened. I believe that white cows, when they eat green grass, grow purple spots. And I say, guys, I've got a theory. What do you think of it? You say, Kyle, well, we'd have to see some evidence for that. And I said, well, of course, everyone needs evidence to back up a theory. So I said, just go outside with me and look at this herd of white cows that I have. And I took you outside and you saw 10 or 12 white cows that I had. And I said, if you'll notice what they're eating, after lunch you will see they're eating green grass, but after lunch it only takes a few hours for those purple spots to pop up. After lunch, I'm just going to invite you guys to come back out to this herd of cows, and I want you to see if they've grown purple spots. And after lunch, sure enough, you walk out there and you see all 12 of those cows are covered with purple spots. And I ask you a simple question, what were they eating before lunch? You say green grass. Another simple question, what do they have now on their bodies? Purple spots. And one of you walks over to one of those cows and you put your hand on the side of that cow, and as you take your hand back, you notice that some of that purple comes off on your hand. And you pull a handkerchief out and you wipe one of those purple spots and you wipe the entire spot off. And you realize that those spots are painted on there. And you come up to me and you say, Kyle, those cows didn't grow those spots, you painted them. And I said, I know, but it's extremely visual, isn't it? You can really see it. Well, yeah, you can see it. Because if you get to make up the information that supposedly proves a theory, and then when it's shown to be false, you say, yeah, but we use it because you can see it so well. Well, look at this next statement. He says, we want to get across the idea of selective adaptation. Later on, they can look at the situation more critically. You ever stop to think when later on is? Did you know later on's not in middle school? Because in the middle school textbooks, it's filled with stuff like this English peppered moth. Later on's not in the high school textbooks. Do you know later on's not in the college textbooks? Because the college textbooks have this same material in them supposedly proving evolution. When is later on? One of the gentlemen involved in looking at this evidence had a PhD before he ever saw the fault of the English peppered moth scenario. When is later on? It is the sad case that many times later on simply means if a child or a teenager has the chance to view some material from a creationist organization that points out the flaws of this type of information. And that is the sad state of later on. This is certainly not the only example of this. This is a man by the name of Ernst Haeckel. Ernst Haeckel in 1860 in Germany. The book by Charles Darwin had just been translated into German. It was written, of course, in 1859, The Origin of Species by Natural Selection. And Haeckel read it in 1860 and thought, wow, this is phenomenal. This is a wonderful idea, and I want to find evidence to prove this. And so he went about doing just that. He went about searching for evidence that he thought proved evolution, and he came up with this idea that there was evidence that proved evolution. He said you can look at an embryo of an organism, and you can watch it trace its evolutionary history. And he came up with a term for this. He said ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. And the students that would come into his class would sit and listen in awe as he would say, class, I would like to show you one of the most profound evidences that prove evolution. Ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. And his students would say, wow, did you know ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny? What in the world does that mean? Well, that's a good question. It means that the stages that an embryo goes through, its ontogeny, replays or repeats its evolutionary history, its phylogeny. Here's what it means in a nutshell. You can watch a human embryo, and it will start as a single-celled organism, and then it will change into something like a fish, and then it will change into something like a lizard, and then it will change into something like a mammal, and eventually come into the human state that it is going to have. And they said, Haeckel, what's the evidence for this? And he said, well, let me show you some pictures. And here they are. These are the pictures that Haeckel drew. Now, what I want you to understand is that these are not an isolated case used in some obscure textbook somewhere that we are pulling out of the air, out of the back shelf. This is standard evolutionary fare. It's right here on page, let's see, of this book. You can find it. Same pictures. Let me read to you the caption. The embryos of vastly different animals look quite similar during the earliest stages of development. These similarities in development hint at genes inherited from a common ancestor. He said, yeah, look at the top row of those embryos. They've all got gill slits. That's the fish stage. And then he said, if you look at how closely they resemble each other, he says, friends, that is evolution in action. He only had one problem. Those weren't really pictures of the embryos. Some of them he drew from memory, and some of them he would draw a single embryo and name it three different things: a chicken, a dog, a pig. Well, the people who actually studied embryos and saw what they looked like said, Haeckel, these aren't real embryos. These aren't really pictures of embryos. You know what he said? Yeah, that's true. They're not, really. And in the 1870s, this information was disproven. And yet in 1999, it was used in the University of Western Florida's science textbook. I recently delivered a lecture similar to this in a school situation, and the teacher who had invited me had gone to the University of Western Florida and used that very textbook, in which Haeckel's embryos are pictured as proof of evolution. Let me read to you a statement by Stephen Jay Gould. He wrote this statement in a magazine called Natural History, a very prominent, prevalent, distributed magazine. He wrote an article titled Atrocious. And in this article, he is describing some things that happen in science that he believes are atrocious. And guess what one of those things is? Read this with me. Haeckel remains most famous today as the chief architect and propagandist for a famous argument that science disproved long ago, but that popular culture has never fully abandoned. Do you mean to tell me that Haeckel's embryos were disproved long ago? Oh, yes. 120 years ago, and yet the University of Western Florida and hundreds of schools all over the country are using books that still use it to prove evolution. Do you know why you can't look at evolution critically? Well, because if you do, you will see that much of the information that supposedly proves it has been disproven for 100 years or so. Read with me what else Stephen Jay Gould says. He says, we should therefore not be surprised that Haeckel's drawings entered 19th century textbooks. But we do, I think, have the right to be both astonished and ashamed by the century of mindless recycling that has led to the persistence of these drawings in a large number, if not the majority of modern textbooks. He said, you know, it's one thing for those to get in there originally, but we should be astonished and ashamed that they've been in there for 100 years and we've known they don't bear any semblance to a shred of evidence that would suggest that evolution is the case. Do you know who Stephen Jay Gould is? He is not a creationist. He was, during his life, one of the most outspoken atheistic evolutionists that lived during his time. And he says we should be ashamed. That's right. Folks, they should be ashamed, because that is unconscionable, to be teaching something that has been false and they've known it for 100 years. Let me ask you this question. Why do you think this is? Why do you think that books like the one that we have shown you are filled with things like the English peppered moth, filled with things like Haeckel's embryos. It's only a 100-page book. Do you know why it's filled with information like this? Because if it weren't, it'd be a 3-page book. And those 3 pages would have things like this probably, possibly, might have, there's a chance that. That's why. Continue with me. These are books that have used Haeckel's embryos to teach evolution. South Huntington School District honors biology in Huntington Station, New York. The 1999, maybe this is hitting a little closer to home, Texas Board of Education adopted this book for the entire state. And it uses Haeckel's embryos as evidence for evolution. Biology, the Unity and Diversity of Life, used at the University of Tennessee in Martin, used in Biology 101 at Central Michigan University, all use this information as proof for evolution. And folks, I'm just touching the tip of the iceberg. There are hundreds of textbooks that use this. In fact, Stephen Jay Gould said, in probably the majority of textbooks. Maybe you'll recognize this particular drawing. This is horse evolution, or so we're told. We are told that this little tiny creature at the end of this line, or you might say at the beginning, about the size of a fox terrier, Eohippus or Don horse, eventually evolved up into modern equus, modern equine, modern horse. And we are told that these fossils that we have found prove this transition from this little bitty horse-like creature all the way up to modern horse. In fact, I was just up at the Natural History Museum in Washington, D.C. Your tax dollars paid for me to visit the Washington Natural History Museum. Anybody that wants to can walk in there for free. I did. I was along with probably several thousand children that day walking in for free because our tax dollars have paid to set up this particular museum. I walked up to the shrine of horse evolution. I bet this particular exhibit cost $250,000. And it was exactly what you see depicted in this picture. That tiny Eohippus evolving into modern horse. And they said this was proof that horses evolved over multiplied millions of years. You know the only problem with this? The only problem with this is the evolutionists themselves admit that this is not the case. George Gaylord Simpson said, and this was in 1953, "The uniform continuous transformation of Hyracotherium, or Eohippus, into Equus, so dear to the hearts of generations of textbook writers, never happened in nature." Where did it happen? On the pages of their textbooks. And that's the only place. Folks, this is not a creationist. This man was a staunch evolutionist. Read with me what Stephen Jay Gould said. "Once ensconced in textbooks, misinformation..." Now stop right there if you will. What kind of information? Misinformation. What did Daniel Dennett say he was going to do with your children at his earliest opportunity? He said he was going to disabuse them of the idea that creation is true, and he was going to tell them that anyone who teaches their children creation is spreading falsehoods. And yet we have on record Stephen Jay Gould himself saying that the information that was used to teach evolution, much of it or some of it in his opinion here, is misinformation. Now continue with me. He says, "It becomes cocooned and effectively permanent because, as stated above, textbooks copy from previous text. I've written 2 essays on this lamentable practice. One on the amusingly perennial description of the Eohippus or Don horse as the size of a fox terrier, even though most authors, including yours truly, have no idea of the dimensions of the breed." Here's what angers me about Stephen Jay Gould's statement. Look how he approaches this. The amusingly perennial idea. Is it amusing to you that someone would know for 50 years that a piece of evidence is false and still use it to tell a child that his parent is a liar? Is that funny to you? Because it's not funny to me. It's not amusing to me that this misinformation has become cocooned in these textbooks and is used to propagate evolution even though we've known it's false for 50 years. That's not funny to me. And I think something needs to be done about it. And what needs to be done is people need to have the opportunity to look at this information or misinformation with an open mind and to study it carefully and to consider it critically. This particular creature is supposed to be, his name means the basal root ancestor, Ardipithecus ramidus cadaba. He was on the front of Time magazine. And he was said to be the basal root ancestor. And what that means is an ancestor to humans that was almost the very first, right at the base, right at the root of the tree. Well, they said about this particular creature, well, we found about 11 bone fragments from 5 different individuals. So you're averaging about 2 bone fragments per individual. And then they said, now researchers haven't found enough bone fragments to reconstruct what Ardipithecus ramidus cadaba looked like. Well, I wish they would have told that to the Time magazine article illustrator, because it sure looks like on the cover of Time magazine, they feel like they've got a pretty good idea of what he looked like. In fact, he's staring at you knowingly and intelligently through the underbrush there, isn't he? Oh, and yet they say to us, they found a single toe bone. And they have a huge picture of the toe bone in their article, and they say this toe bone proves that the creature walked upright. Now, there are a lot of things that would have to be involved for a creature to walk upright. His hips would have to be placed correctly. His leg bones would have to be the proper stature and size and dimensions. All kinds of things would need to be in place, and it would be hard to tell from a toe bone if a creature walked upright or not, but that's not what's most disturbing to me about this particular find. This toe bone that they say proves that this creature walked upright, let me tell you what else they say about it. They say, oh, the toe bone? Well, it was separated in time by several hundred thousand years and it was found 10 miles away from the rest of them. Now, I don't agree at all with the evolutionary dating methods. But they said, we found 11 bones of 5 different specimens, averaging about 2 bones per specimen. And we found a toe bone after we got in our car and drove for 10 minutes at 60 miles an hour and got out, stuck a shovel in the ground, pulled out a toe bone that wasn't connected in any way to the other bones that we found. In fact, so much was not connected that we dated it several hundred thousand years separate. But this toe bone is what proves that whatever creature had those 11 other specimens walked on 2 legs upright. Now, is that good science to you? I certainly think you'll see that it is not. You might recall Piltdown Man. In 1912, Piltdown Man was hailed as the missing link. We were told in 1912 that this was evidence that humans evolved from ape-like creatures. In fact, over 500 articles were written discussing Piltdown Man. In 1925, at the Scopes Monkey Trial, as it's referred to, the scientific experts wrote in their documents that Piltdown Man was evidence that humans evolved from ape-like creatures. For 40 years, Piltdown Man was analyzed and looked at by the most educated people in the world. And they said, oh, absolutely, this is the missing link. This is the link between humans and ape-like creatures. And yet in 1952, 40 years after Piltdown Man was discovered, they took a more critical look, a closer look, a more open-minded look, and they discovered, Piltdown Man was constructed using the skull of a human and the jawbone of an orangutan that was artificially colored to look old and whose teeth were filed down to fit with the human skull. And yet for 40 years it was hailed as a link between humans and monkeys. What's the problem here? Do you know what the problem is? The problem is looking at evolutionary information critically with an open mind and analyzing it carefully proves that evolution did not take place. And still we are forced to the conclusion that in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth.